Hi, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a response of the day from the 14th day of Shvat. We thank the OU, Rabbi Jacob Bromwitz and David Hauchhauser, for making this shiurim available to you online. And today we're going to see mostly a tshuva by Rav Herzog from Shut Orach Mishpat Orach Chaim Siman Yud Chet, dated to the 14th of Shvat of Tofresh Tzadi He of 1935. And he's writing to Rav Uziel, who eventually become the Sephardi Chief Rabbi of Israel, but at this point is the Chief Rabbi of Yafo and Tel Aviv in the area. Interestingly, back in 1935, they still referred to it as Mechoz Yafo Tel Aviv, as the area of Yafo Tel Aviv, whereas I think today it's Tel Aviv Yafo, because Tel Aviv is such a much larger city. So he thanks him for sending him parts of Mishpatei Uziel, of his Sefer. And he wants to comment on the first tshuva in the book, which I think we may have seen together at some other time in the calendar, but I'm not sure. And I have no easy way to find out because it's all spread through various files in my computer. But Rav Uziel had taken the position that changing your accent, your Hebrew accent, is not a halachic problem. The issue that was arising already in 1935 becomes obviously much, much more significant as time went on. And thank God more Jews came to Israel from different places who had different pronunciations. Rav Uziel was talking about certain Yemenite Jews, I think that Rav Herzog is going to refer to as well. And Rav Uziel said he didn't think it was a problem of Al Titosh Torat Imecha. We're going to see in the Tshuva, but as a background, I can mention already that Al Titosh Torat Imecha, it's a pasuk in Mishlei, Shema B'ni Musar Avicha, accept or listen to or heed to the Musar, the discipline of your father. Al Titosh Torat Imecha, and don't abandon the Torah of your mother. So your mother in that context had been taken as a reference to not your mother literally, it's also your mother literally, but also as a reference to the Jewish people and to the customs of the time would be Torat Imecha. So we're supposed to adhere to customs. So if I grew up in a certain environment, a certain family, a certain city, then I'm supposed to adhere to the customs of that city, certainly while I'm still living there. And abandoning them would be a violation, a problem of not being, of Al Titosh Torat Imecha. I would be not adhering, I would be not following, I have used that word twice already, I apologize. I would be not following the dictates of my mother, which is what Mishlei told me to do. So Rav Uziel had said, that's not true of language pronunciation. We're not going to talk about his reasons, because that's not our tshuva here. We're going to talk about Rav Herzog's response to that and why he thinks it's not true. Because he, Rav Herzog, had been asked by some Yemenite Jews, should they change their Hebrew pronunciation? Now, it's a little ironic that Rav Herzog, the Ashkenazic rabbi, tells them, no, stick to your Taimonic, to your Yemenite pronunciation, whereas Rav Uziel, who's the Sephardic rabbi, is going to tell him not to. Now, the truth is, Rav Uziel was hoping for, and this is one of the places it comes up in other places as well, but Rav Uziel was hoping for a unified pronunciation to come up, that now that Jews are coming back to Israel, they would have some kind of a big conference, they would all pick and choose and understand a unified version of pronouncing Hebrew, and that would become the thing, because for him, unity was certainly more important than the custom issue. So again, we're not going to talk about him so much. I just happen to know that, and when I know stuff, I like to mention it because I know so little. So Herzog says that if you look in Perek Makom Shenago, the fourth chapter of Psachim, is where all this stuff gets talked about, because that's where it starts off by saying in Makom Shenago that they had a custom to work or not work on Erev Pesach. So that the Gemara says that if you're in that place, you have to follow it. So the reasons are maybe Al Titosh Torat Imecha, and another reason is Al Yishane Adam Ipnei HaMachloket, that you shouldn't act differently than people around you, because it leads to dispute, to strife, and I think maybe, I'm not positive about this, but it's recently occurred to me that it might also just mean even just division. Meaning, machloket we often think of as, let's say, Korach's machloket, where he like gets the Jewish people and they rebel against Moshe, and that's machloket. Or machloket is we all hate each other, we're all very angry at each other. But I think it might just be division. It leads to people doing different things, and we shouldn't do that. We shouldn't be creating separations and division within the Jewish people. And Herzog said that's an isur gamur. It's a complete prohibition. And when it comes to being mishaneh davar, changing something in machloket that we're not supposed to do it, so that is a distinction within custom that comes up in the earlier literature that he's going to refer to, that both he and Rav Uziel knew about, so he just refers to it casually. I'll point it out that there was a distinction that had been made between the menhagim, which is a matter of Isser, but sometimes there's a menhag that's just a menhag that arose. It has no issue, nothing to do with prohibitions or not. So there's a menhag which is a question of prohibition, meaning let's say we paskin that this is allowed, but the custom arose not to do it. Kidney would be a good example of that. We think it's allowed, but the custom became to treat it as if it was chametz because we're worried that maybe whatever it is. So that's a menhag that has to do with the prohibition. Then there are menhagim that are just menhagim, and nobody thinks that it has anything to do with allowed or not allowed. It's just a menhag that arose, and therefore you would do that. And then all the time there's something that's immediately lechetchila. We should do it as lechetchila, and that became the custom. Or afilu midat chisud because he do be alma, or just like a best possible way. So those are different kinds of minhagim. So Rav Herzog is saying that in all the different kinds of minhagim, if it's an issue of creating machloket, he doesn't think that any of that distinction arises. There are areas in halacha, in the halachic literature, that say that depending on what kind of minhag it is, you might be more or less allowed to change it depending on what it is. So the Ran, this is what it's all building off of. The Ran had written that a minhag iser be'ir echad, if there's a minhag to prohibit something, that we treat something as if it's prohibited, to understand something to be prohibited in a particular city, then everybody in that city has to follow that minhag, min hadin, because of al titosh torat yimecha, because of the pasuk. But Rav Herzog's point is going to be, that's only when it's a minhag isur, but and that's only when the concern is al titosh torat yimecha. But if the custom is a custom that could lead to the machloket, that will be also something that everybody's required to stay away from division in, because it could lead to machloket. So the tshuva that Rav Uziel had mentioned is a tshuva in the Maharashdam. The Maharashdam, who lived in the 16th century in Amsterdam, I think it was an important poseg, he had talked about custom issues, because what had happened was, we're going to see, is that Bashar al-Ashkenazim had come to town, and they had wanted to keep to their own minhagim in terms of davening, because the Sephardim, they didn't like the Sephardi davening. So Maharashdam had said, or maybe around. Maybe they had already, they'd been davening like the Ashkenazim, and then a bunch of Sephardim came to town and they wanted to daven the Sephardi way, and the Maharashtam was going to tell them they can. So the Maharashtam says, Dafka kaminhag sheish bot sat isur. It's only when there's a matter of prohibition, but so how we pronounce davening, how what actual prayers we say, isn't usually a matter, or almost always a matter of isur, of prohibition. So then, al titosh torat imecha, don't abandon the Torah of your mother, doesn't come into play. And Rav Harshtam had said, it only comes to that Torah, al titosh torat imecha, as we're talking about when you have an individual, he can't change from the minhag of the city. Even when, now the Maharashtam claims, even when he left the city, that's a surprising question about whether or not you have to keep the minhagim of your city you came from when you move away, if you leave and don't want to come back. But let's say you leave and plan to come back, you have to keep those minhagim for sure. But, says Rav Herzog, if there's going to be machloket involved, though, kegon l'shanot bifnei rabim minhagam hakavua b'makom shrabim omdim. So if it's going to be not, meaning one question is, I'm davening in private, I'm doing something in private, it's just me, nobody else really going to know, so do I have to do what the community does or not? That would be an al titosh torat yimecha question. That's where the Maharashtam says that the Ran said it's only for minhag isur. It's only for a minhag that has to do with something that might be prohibited, and the questions of permitted or prohibited. But says Rav Herzog, if the question is about, I'm going to now act in a different way than the common custom of that town, in front of them, in a place that lots of people around, so there it's any minhag, he thinks. It doesn't matter whether it's a minhag that has an Easter, that has a prohibition attached to it, it's just a problem, because you can't change in front of people in a way that's going to create machloket, and he says that he thinks the Ran and the Maharashtam would agree that you can't change it. And he says he thinks that's the actually essential meaning of al titosh torat yimecha. Al titosh torat yimecha is fundamentally about when there are a lot of people going to see what you're doing, and you're going to be changing from them, and you're going to be creating machloket by doing so. And Rav Herzog says, and there's no surprise that this is the ruling, because anything that has to do with custom, the main part of it is hamshachat shalom, is to create peace in a community. They all have the same, they handle Judaism in their same way. It creates a unity and a sense of peace among them. And Chazal actually in Gittin and Tehillim Bet said even more, said Elu Dvarim Mibnei Darkei Shalom. There's all sorts of things that we do Mibnei Darkei Shalom, like giving a Kohen the first aliyah. Truth is, halacha is that the Kohen should get the first aliyah if there's no greater Torah scholar than that Kohen there. But if there's a greater Torah scholar, then the Torah scholar should get it. So we don't do that anymore, because we want to create Darkei Shalom. And they bring a bunch of psukim there, and in the discussion there, so they say it's Darkei Shalom in the Mishnah. So Abai says, Rav Yosef, I don't understand. Rav Yosef says it's a Doraita of a Kidashto, and it's because of Darkei Shalom. Abai says the whole Torah is Darkei Shalom. And it says, Dichachecha Darkei Noam. Its ways are ways of pleasantness. So it sees that the Torah is supposed to be about something that produces more peace. Now that's a complicated thing to say in our times, when lots of people do lots of stuff that requires a certain reaction, and you wouldn't only be peaceful about it. Same thing in the time of the Gemara. Suddenly somebody just decided to start violating Shabbos in public in a biblical way, you wouldn't just say, oh, well, let's be peaceful about it. So it means, barring something forcing us to act unpeaceably about it, we want to be peaceful in these things as much as we can. It does mean, however, for custom, that any place where we have to worry, or we think that by observing our version of a custom, we're going to interrupt the peace or violate the peace or create less peace, so then the machloka, then we have to worry about it, and then you have an alti toshtu ati mecha of don't do anything that's going to create machloket, and don't therefore differ from other people who are doing what they already do, if it's going to create strife, division, or machloket. And when Barashdam says you can continue davening, you can daven like this Friday way. So he says it a little unclearly here, and I think I'm missing something, because I think the answer, so the way he says it here is the Barashdam had a community that had been davening this Sfard, like a Sephardi thing, and even the Ashkenazim in town were by now already so used to Nusach Sephardi that if you put in the Ashkenazi version of davening, they wouldn't even know how to daven anymore, they would get it wrong. And then new people came who wanted to go back to the Ashkenazic minhag, and he told them they couldn't. But I think he had said they couldn't if it's a matter of Isser. In any case, the point is that it's the machloket factor that was central for the Maharashtam, that you don't want to have a machloket, and these people would be creating a machloket by going to that thing. So that's where he brings up the whole question of Isser Mamash. But he says, what I'm asked about, so he was talking about the Nusach HaTfilah, and later on in the Tshuva, I will say it now and not get it later, he also says that he thinks the Maharashtam actually liked the Sephardi davening better, thought the Sephardi davening was halachically better, because they didn't say so many piyutim, and that the Maharashtam, along with many other authorities, thought that piyutim, the liturgical poetry that fills up some of our davening to nowadays, that mostly fills Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Kinot, and Slichos, and things like that, but that fills up much of davening, that he didn't like that. And there were many people who didn't like that throughout Jewish history, so we Ashkenazim do it, but that was part of the Herzog suggests that was part of the calculus in the Maharashtam's head when he said, yeah, stick with the Nusach Sfar, you don't have to worry about it. But what he was asked about, there was a whole community of people who speak Hebrew a certain way, and now there are individuals within that community who are trying to get the whole community, force the whole community to switch to another Hebrew pronunciation. So he thinks that's a complete Easter of Alti Tosh Tatebech. I mean, Uziel had said it's not Alti Tosh, because he had this Barash Dab who said Alti Tosh only applies really to matters of Isser. And other stuff has other reasons, but that's all it really applies to. And Rav Herzog is saying, no, that's not what Barash Dab meant at all. Barash Dab meant that if you're going to have the situation that he had there, but now our situation, there's no, you're not creating a machloket here. It's more that you'd be creating a machloket if you try to force people to switch their pronunciation to another version of Hebrew, because almost everybody pronounces Hebrew in that community in the Teimani way. And therefore, all the worries we have about Alti Tosh Torati Mech, about creating a machloket, and all these things, and then also, he points out, referred to Rav Uziel, has spoken about this as well, but Hebrew pronunciation has importance for various things, like if I'm saying the letters wrong, some of my tefillot might not be valid, some of my fulfillment of the reading of Shema, right? If anybody reads Shema and they swallow the words or they mispronounce the words, it either is not a fulfillment, but it's certainly not as good a fulfillment. The question of the line between you didn't fulfill the law, you have to go back and do it again or not, is a question of its own. But certainly it's supposed to be fulfilled in a way where you're saying the words clearly. So if I'm let's say I'm an Ashkenazi, and I try to pronounce the Hebrew in the Teimani way, so A, I'll probably get it wrong. But besides to get it wrong, from my Ashkenazic perspective of the way Hebrew works, I'm saying it in a way that is almost unintelligible. Right, I've mentioned this before, but I once heard a true Galitzianer, read the Torah, and I almost couldn't understand what he was saying. So if I pronounced Hebrew as the Galitzianer did, and let's say I did it well, it might still be true that from my traditional perspective, in terms of the tradition that I come from, that I'm not pronouncing the letters right. And Herzog says, that's not right. Meaning, the Teimanim are coming with a tradition of the way Hebrew letters are pronounced. If we start saying to them, change your pronunciation, there's the machloket issue that we've already gone into, the division and strife issue. There's the alti Torah Shorati Mecha issue, that you're abandoning the Torah of your mother. But Herzog is saying, here there's a halachic issue as well, that we are maybe drawing them into, and we don't know any better than they do exactly what the tradition of pronunciation is. We're drawing them into not pronouncing Hebrew right, and therefore not fulfilling mitzvot correctly. And the Sefer Chinuch had said that it might even be true that if you pronounce it that way, you are b'di'eved lo yatsa. You're not even yotzei, even if I come to the rabbi and I say, listen, rabbi, I said, you know, Parsha Zachar, I said Shema, I said whatever I said, and I said it in a different pronunciation, you know. Today it wouldn't be a thing, but let's suppose I pronounced it in a British accent, I pronounced English in a British accent, there was some declaration I had to make, and I pronounced it in a perfect British accent, But I'm an American, so I should have used an American accent. So halachically, the Sefer Chinuch says, that might be a problem because my tradition tells me the pronunciation of Hebrew is this, and I've done it a completely different way. And in some of the different accents, their way of pronouncing it might count as a swallowing of the letter in my tradition. And therefore, says Rav Herzog, there's no way that we can require a community to change their custom of how to speak Hebrew because we're trying to ask them then to maybe not fulfill the Torah by their stances and by their lights. And then he throws in, I think it's such an interesting line, because obviously it happened, but he said, Rak mashem mitaveh me'ilav al yedei hachinuch. Whatever happens, if as the kids go to schools, and everybody around them, or the majority of people around them, are not Teimanim, they're Sfaradim or Ashkenazim, and they develop a different Hebrew pronunciation, he's comfortable with that. So I know of Ashkenazim who are not comfortable. I know of Ashkenazim for sure. I don't know that they want their names bandied about in public, but I know of Ashkenazim for sure who moved to Israel, became Israelis, as it were, and pronounced Hebrew in the ordinary Israeli street fashion. But when they daven, you know, Nusach Ashkenaz. They daven not Nusach. They daven Havara Ashkenazis, right? They'll pronounce words like in Ashkenaz as Ashkenaz, and the Hebrew is Ashkenazis, right? So they'll do it that way. They'll read the Torah that way. They'll say Shema that way. So Rav Herzog, when he says, but the chinuch, when the educational system changes it, that'll be okay, that's a kind of a jump to make, because if his claim was that the Tamanim have, the Yemenites have their way of pronouncing Hebrew, and halachically, they understand that to be the correct way to pronounce it, and therefore, when you try to get the change, you're getting them to change, not only has halachic ramifications, you would have said, so they have to keep trying to practice it that way. So that's an interesting question of his own. He seems not so concerned about that because I think he thinks that as long as it's not willful and it just sort of naturally evolves, it'll be okay. Although that wouldn't be true of other customs that people have. But that's what he says. But, and he says it especially to contrast to the case of where they come to ask us the question. They're going to ask us the question, should they change? And there's clearly a machloket issue to it. So either because people are going to be object and fight about it, or just because you're going to create splits in the community between those who do change and those who change. So then we have to tell them, no, you shouldn't change because you have a minhag avot, you have a custom of your forefathers, you should keep to your custom of your forefathers. So then he says, and even where there's no machloket, so I think by no machloket, he might just mean nobody's going to fight about it. They're all willing to accept the ruling and agree to it. Or he might mean, as I suggested, that nobody's going to split up because of it. Either way, he says, we still can't do it because it's a minhag of their forefathers. So how can we be so cavalier about minhagim of their forefathers when there's some effect on mitzvahs? Now, and that's where he says the Maharashtam said that it was a piyut issue, that he thinks the Maharashtam had a piyut issue, that lots of Rishonim and Achronim didn't like piyut anyway. And that's why the Maharashtam was in favor of keeping Nusach Sfar. So he had some other halakhic motivation than just the pure minhag discussion. Of course, once you start letting yourself say that, then you start looking for ulterior motives in various kinds of response, and you may get yourself in the hot water. But for this Juva here, Rav Herzog was comfortable saying that he thinks the Maharashtam had a question about whether or not they can continue the minhag, and since he had this question about the minhag game, and he had the background issue of piyut, he thought that that was part of what led Maharashtam to rule the way he did. But when it comes to pronunciation, well, we don't know about a pronunciation. It happens to be that I think Uziel in his tshuva had mentioned that he thought linguists held that the Sephardi pronunciation, not the Teimani, the Sephardi pronunciation was the most closest to the tradition. I think that helped Rav Uziel come to his conclusions. But Rav Herzog says, we don't have any real way of knowing what it is. So what would lead us to allow a changing of personal custom, and of not just personal custom, of communal custom. Especially another factor here, and this I think is related to the machloket fact that's bothering Herzog so much, especially when much of that community, whether or not they'll accept it, but much of that community sees it as an insult to the dignity of their forefathers and of their rabbis and of their communal leaders, right? They come to Israel and all of a sudden told, oh, the way you pronounce Hebrew, that's nothing. Now, this is 1935, so it's way early. But the way the Yemenites were eventually treated in Jewish history, in the history of the State of Israel, would certainly would promote and support Rav Herzog's worry about it because they were treated in a way that very much did deny the dignity and of the communities from which they came. So that's what Herzog was worried about already. And then he points out that there's a Maharshal who allows for a change of custom in his time in terms of when a woman is going to mikvah should shampoo and carefully clean out her hair before going to the mikvah. So he allowed that to be at night when it used to be during the day, and it was supposed to be in the day because that's when you could check it, because you had daylight to check it by. So when he gives the support for changing it, Herzog points out, he goes into all of these reasons about what's wrong with doing it the way they'd been doing it until now, and therefore that forced them to change it to when they were changing to. The point is that without that pressure, as we're first saying, without that great pressure to change, then they wouldn't allow changing a minhag avot, a custom of the forefathers. And therefore, here too, when you don't have that many reasons, he thinks it's important not to change it. And he points out, as we've mentioned on other occasions, this is Yushami, this is minhag mevatel halakha. There are times when a minhag can be even stronger than an actual halakha. That's got a lot of details. It's not just a simple claim to make, but it shows that, it can't be a minhag, for example, that just cropped up. It has to be a minhag that important rabbinic leaders had been part of the process of bringing into being. But it does mean that when you have a minhag, and here he says it's chas v'shalom to say that pronunciation wasn't set up by communal leaders, which is an interesting claim of its own, because you might have thought to yourself, pronunciation tends to, as he's implied in the tshuva itself, it tends to develop more organically than that, rather than being top down, rather than being imposed top down. It's true. The leaders of communal will say, this is the way we should teach people to speak Hebrew, and this is the right way to speak Hebrew, and they'll have rules about who can lean and when they can lean and stuff like that, and that will help a lot. But I don't know if that's the same thing as saying that it's the leaders of the community who absolutely establish proper pronunciation. But he's saying once it is, we can't treat that minhag lightly, and therefore we have to treat it with great respect. And unless we have tremendous reasons to change it, we shouldn't be doing that. Then he says, and we find the Ramah quotes the Maharil, that even when it comes to the Nigunim and the Piyutim, so we've talked about Piyut already, but the tunes that people daven with. So the Ramah quotes the Maharil, says you shouldn't change that so easily. But the fundamental point that he wants to make is that when it comes to Minhag, you don't want people changing quickly or promiscuously is the wrong word, but quickly or easily or casually, and doing it only the way that they think that it is, because then you're going to have a situation where everybody says what they want, they follow the latest fad and minhagim, and you don't want that, right? You don't want even in relatively unimportant minhagim, you want people doing something that the rabbinic leadership is directing and showing that it has real value to it. He points to a Rambam who says that when it comes to a Rabbanan, that's an actual, rabbinic rule is actually a biblical rule, because the pasuk in the Torah says lo tasur. We can't stray from what the rabbi said. I actually recently had a conversation with somebody who said, it's just a Rabbanan. I said, yeah, but for the Rambam, that's actually a delright. He said, the Rambam doesn't really mean that, but the answer is the Rambam really did mean that. That's what Herzog is saying, that lo tasur makes every Rabbanan into a delraita. And then when the Rambam is writing about the ability to change things or not change things, or the requirement that we have to follow because of lo tasur, he doesn't differentiate. He says that lotasur applies to things that Chazal had a tradition about, things that they derived on their own with the proper rules for deriving new ideas from the Torah, the Midot HaTorah, and address it by hand, that siyagim, and then when he lists siyagim, it's siyagim like fences. So he says those are the gzerot, they are the decrees, they are the tekanot, the ordinances. A decree is like, don't do this, and a tekanah is more like, make sure to do this, I think, and the customs. So you see that for the Rambam, customs that rabbis institute become like a derabbanan, and then because they become like a derabbanan, it means they really like deraita, and therefore it all falls into that rubric. The point being that minhagim therefore have that level of severity or seriousness that we wouldn't have necessarily thought, and that's what the Herzog wants us to realize. And especially, he says, just because when it comes to ordinary language, and this is a challenge the Jews had not met for a long time before this, just because in ordinary language Jews had gotten used to pronouncing Hebrew in a certain way, doesn't mean that we can switch or change the forms of pronunciation of Hebrew that we have for davening and for reading the Torah and for all those kinds of things that we have as tradition from our forefathers. Everybody's got to wait. And then he adds the kicker that I think people also don't remember. Ad asher ye'ere aleinu ruach mimarom, until we get a divine spirit on us, bevo goel tzedek, v'shavu shoftinik oration, until we get our judges back, which he means, I think, the Sanhedrin, v'az neida eze derech yishkon or lashiv v'chol am Hashem chuka achat b'lishinu yifalu b'diot u'menagim. At that point, he says, yeah, we're going to get to the unity that Rav Uziel used to write about a lot. He said, at that point, we will get to that unity, because we'll have a Sanhedrin, and they'll decide what everybody should do, and everybody will do the same thing. That's another one of those comments that he's sure of, and that I'm not sure you had to be so sure of, because theoretically, you could say the Sanhedrin would come along, but they wouldn't change all minhagim, right? If you look at the rules the Rambam has for what can be changed, what cannot be changed, it's not so clear how that is, but he quotes a pasuk in Yechezkel, Lamed Zayin, Yutet, that the tree of Judea and the tree of Ephraim, meaning the two kingdoms, will come back together, and he's accepting that to mean they'll come back together fully and completely in all of their minhagim, because you'll have a central Sanhedrin that will make rules about all these things. I am not completely convinced that's true. But for the purpose of the tshuva, what he's shown us and what he's reminded us is that when it comes to minhagim, there's a lot of questions about when we do change minhagim or don't change minhagim, when we're allowed to, we're not allowed to. And there are more conservative, small C conservative people, and then more liberal people. Uziel thought that Hebrew pronunciation did not fall into the rubric of minhag that we had to worry about changing. Erev Herzog thought it did. And then the last speech of the Tshuva, he says, but I've already written many times that the words of the Torah scholar, Shtiri Chachamim, Dinachat Nishbeim, have to be heard Binachat, which means the Torah scholar should say the Binachat, and make sure not to make a machloket out of this, a dispute out of this. And here in our tshuva, it's obviously why, because he's saying the whole reason not to change customs is because it'll create machloket. So you create machloket in not changing the customs, you're sort of defeating yourself. So whatever the halach is, the most important thing is we find a peaceful way to handle. And that is Rav Herzog's perspective of changing Hebrew accents. Things, it shouldn't be done. The timanim should not be asked, required, or forced to change their custom, because that is their communal custom for how to pronounce Hebrew. It takes one day we'll get to a more unified pronunciation, and it is whatever we're going to do about it, we should do it with an eye out to maintaining, sustaining, or recreating peace in the Jewish people. Okay, with the time that's left to me, I want to do a brief tshuva, a brief response to Min Chatam Sofer. It's also dated for the 14th of Shvat of Tuf Kuf Tzadi Dalet of 1834. This is from Shul Chatam Sofer Aleph Orach Chaim, Siman Kuf Yudchet. Rav Herzog's tshuva was Yudchet, this is Kuf Yudchet. If you see any significance of that, congratulations. Here's the question. A Jew apparently owned a tavern, but instead of running the tavern, he had rented out the tavern, or leased the tavern, to a non-Jew for a year or three, and the non-Jew got all of the profits. The non-Jew was going to run the tavern, he gets all the profits from the tavern itself, right? So and he doesn't pay rent. That's not the way it works. All that he does is, All the drinks that he buys, the vodka, the scotch, the beer, the whatever it is, he buys from the Jew. And then he sells it, right? So anything he can buy from the Jew, in other words, the Jew has to be his sole supplier of that. And from there, the Jew's going to make enough money that it's worth his while to let the guy have the tavern. That's the arrangement that they have. Now, it's true that he doesn't pay him every single time. They figure out, they have a set price for the stuff that he's going to be supplying him, and some of this stuff is chametz drinks. That's like beer, you know, or scotch. It's things that are chametz, so it's going to be a Pesach question. So they figure out how much he owes, and then he pays him every so often, right? They write it down in a notebook, and they pay him. So everybody in the neighborhood, until they thought of this question to bring to the Chatam Sofer, assume that since the chametz really belongs to the non-Jew right away, that as long as he gave him delivery before Pesach, he had no worry. He didn't have to do a mechiras chametz because it's not his anymore, right? Because once he's given it to the non-Jew, the non-Jew is going to sell it as part of the tavern, and there's no backseas on it. And so you think that it's a full sale, and it's not even a legal fiction sale because it really is true. The non-Jew is going to be the one who's going to sell it, and the non-Jew is going to get the profits from the selling of it. So it really belongs to the non-Jew. But now this year, all of a sudden, they realize that maybe since part of the deal is that the Jew has the right to come in and take back something he sold to the non-Jew and replace it, and that's because the Jew might have other contracts that need to be fulfilled. So let's say, you know, the non-Jew usually keeps 3 days of inventory for what he needs for the tavern, and the Jew gets a great offer on some beer. He has the right to come in and take back the beer from the non-Jew, like a day's worth, or 2 days worth, or however the arrangement was, and use that to sell to whoever he was going to sell it. And the non-Jew doesn't have any right to object. So does that make a problem? Does that mean the Jew has some ownership rights in it? And the Chatam Sofer's answer is going to be a problem, I think, for some of us today who sell chametz, because Chatam Sofer says, yeah, I think he does. I think it's a problem. And the problem is that the Gemara in Pesachim says, Shelcha yatarua, anything that belongs to you, you're not allowed to own on Pesach. So when we say Shelcha, that it belongs to you, we don't mean it belongs to you with full Jewish ownership, like in the Torah, everywhere in the Torah. Here, it's something that is available to you in any kind of a way, as long as you have any kind of attachment to it, that's called Shelo. How does he know Shubhaki? He says, Afilu rektavar hago reim lamamon debe alma lav mamon. Even if it's just something that has some kind of, maybe it can cause monetary issues, that'll be enough in chametz and Pesach purposes. So how does he know that? Because, for example, let's say a non-Jew wants to leave chametz with a Jew. It's not the non-Jew, it's the non-Jew's chametz, but he needs a place to keep it, and he wants the non-Jew to watch it for him. So as long as the Jew, as part of that arrangement, is required to reimburse the non-Jew if something should happen to that chametz, it's not allowed on Pesach. because it's the achrayah, that responsibility for it, that's a kind of an ownership. It's a monetary connection to the chametz that halacha assumes is not allowed on Pesach. So too, there are opinions that even if the non-Jew forces the Jew to do it, right, the king comes to town and says, you Jew, take my chametz, wash it, and if something goes up to it, you'll be in trouble. It's still a problem of owning chametz on Pesach because that's considered matzoy lecha. Another example of it is, let's say somebody owns challah tmeya. So challah is a piece of a dough that you need that you're supposed to give to a kohen, and usually today we burn it because we can't do anything with it because it's tameh. So challah tmeya is something that's supposed to be burned, but so you might think, if I own it, it's not mine. It doesn't really belong to me because I can't do anything with it. It's not even the kohen is going to have to burn it. So I wouldn't think that maybe then I violate Pesach by owning it or by having it in my possession. I don't own it. It's not mine. But the answer that the Gemara gives for why we think you do own it is, according to Rabbi Elazar, is because the halacha is that I can, if I want to, say, oh, I don't want that to be the challah. That stuff that I named is challah, I don't want it to be challah. I want this to be challah. So just like in a neder with a vow or an oath, I can nullify it. Dedicating things to be challah, to be hekdesh, is usually considered a kind of an oath, and therefore are susceptible to nullification by being shoel, by going to a chacham and doing like a nullification, finding a way to say that I made an error in my original setting this aside to be challah, and whatever it is. But the point is, our point is, that that's good enough to be considered ownership. There's literally no ownership for the Jew. There's only the possibility of being shoel. There's the possibility of finding a chacham, finding a rabbi who can verify that I made an error in my original declaration of it to be challah. That's good enough. So if that's good enough, it's good enough here too, because the Jew has the ability, if he needs to come and get it and actually take possession of it. Now, obviously, he's not going to on Pesach, but he has the ability to, and that should be good. That is enough that it's a problem. And Bitul, so you say to yourself, okay, well, I'll do Bitul Chametz. Say, I don't want to own that Chametz. I am declaring myself not to be ownership, whatever. So there, he doesn't have enough ownership of it to do that, says the Chatam Sofer, right? Often, we can say, I can be Mivatala, but that's only because I own it. So if I own it, I can say, I don't want it to be mine anymore. But if I don't really own it, all I own is the right to take possession of it. I can't just say, I'm being Mivatala the Chametz. Now, theoretically, the Chatam Sofer doesn't come up with this, but theoretically, I could say, what if I can legally say that over the next 8 days, I'm legally foregoing any right of mine to retake possession, and that's a legal thing, then that should seem to be good enough. But his answer is, before Pesach, you have to take it from the Wirtheiser, I think the tenant in the tavern, and then, oh, I'm sorry, you take it from the tenant in the tavern, and he's basically doing what I said he was doing, I just didn't think of it that that's what he meant, and you give it back to him with the understanding that this chametz that you're giving now, this stuff you're giving to him, you're not going to have the right to take back. And if you do that, then you're okay. And it's, I'm writing quickly, and it's the 14th, the Shroud of Tavkuf Tzadi Dalid, Rav Moshe HaKatan Sofer. So that is two responses a day for the 14th Shvat. One about keeping custom or not keeping custom, where it doesn't apply, especially as it applies to pronouncing Hebrew. And the other, HaKatan Sofer, about the level of ownership that can qualify as ownership. So I have to say today, this is what I meant to say. Today, when we sell chametz, people sell chametz, usually keep it in their house, and they expect to get it back right after Pesach. And, you know, if they were to take it, all that would happen is the non-Jew would say, well, you got to pay me for the stuff that you took, because theoretically, but of course the non-Jew hasn't fully paid for it himself. It's an interesting question to think about. We'll leave it there. But I'm so fair saying that any kind of an ownership interest, any kind of a legal interest in a chametz item means that the person qualifies as an owner and has a problem of owning chametz on Pesach. So those are response day four, 14th of Shvat. Thanks to the OU, Jack Abramowitz, Rabbi Jack Abramowitz, David Hachhauser, and the whole OU. Have a great day.